Welcome to Collections by Michelle Brown. I'm your host, Michelle Brown. Each week, we'll be talking with people living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality, and creating change. Today, I'm once again joined by Michelle Regalado-Dietrich. Michelle lives with her family on an 80-acre farm in southeast Michigan, where she cares for a large organic garden, an orchard, and a 20-acre native prairie surrounded by stands of native trees. For the past two seasons, her family has been unable to plant on most of their farm. This has continued to fuel her interest and concern about the environment and climate change. Michelle is also a poet, a community advocate, an elected official, and an activist for the environment, small farm rights, women, and fair wages. She was served as vice chair of Washtenaw County Commission. In 2016, she ran successfully as a Democrat for the Washtenaw County Board of Commissioners. She was also elected to the Democratic National Committee and was subsequently elected as Midwest representative to the DNC Women's Caucus. At the Democratic National Committee's meeting in San Francisco in August, the party approved establishing the Environmental and Climate Council. This DNC Council was the culmination of months of work, garnering support from 50-plus DNC co-sponsors to ensure passage of a founding resolution and whipping votes. Michelle leads the DNC Environmental and Climate Council team as its chairwoman. The council is here to further the Democratic Party's commitment articulated in the party platform to tackle the climate crisis and protect our earth, air, and water. Michelle, welcome back to Collections by Michelle Brown. How are you today?
I'm doing wonderfully. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, you aren't new to the game. I mean, you have run for office. You've been involved. You have cared about the environment. I mean, you live on a farm, you know. You have an organic garden. You know, you take care of native prairies. So I was not surprised as I watched things going on in San Francisco that you were there talking about the climate crisis, protecting our earth, air, and water. It didn't go totally like what we had hoped, but what was the conversation like in San Francisco, and how aware are people? I mean, how concerned are they about this?
First of all, you are so right about, you know, living on a farm and being aware of what's happening. Of our 80 acres, 40 acres couldn't be planted this year because it never dried out enough to plant.
Mm-hmm.
And this has happened all across the Midwest. You know, and rusts and strain, new insects attacking people's orchards. So especially, you know, owners of small and medium-sized farms, and we have a lot of those here in Michigan, are really feeling the brunt of this, in part because most of the government aid that we hear about, you know, sort of government subsidies to help farmers through tough years, doesn't go to farmers like us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, eventually we're all going to feel this at the supermarket and our food prices. But obviously there's a lot of other concerns with so many communities, and particularly communities with lower income and communities of color, bearing the brunt of the climate disasters that are happening both here and internationally, and the hurricanes and the flooding. And so it was interesting to me at the DNC meeting in San Francisco at the end of August that I think that because of, in part, of people becoming really aware of the news stories that are happening, and that awareness being spurred in turn by a lot of the really great activism led by youth and also by elders, by people who've been in the environmental movement for decades, that there was a general acceptance that I had not sensed before, even as recently as February, that, you know, this is an issue that we have to deal with, that is necessary morally and politically to deal with. And so that was a good change. And I first proposed a climate and environmental council for the DNC, just in conversation starting back last January. I did not get a warm reception at first from many people in leadership positions, but that conversation changed over time. And I think the activism of Sunrise and Our Revolution and the Sierra Club and Climate Hawks, so many other organizations that were really saying we need a climate debate, we need the candidates to address these issues, because I think it became crystal clear, again, both the moral and the political and the pragmatic. We all want our children and grandchildren to have a planet they can live on comfortably, reasons for taking the climate issues seriously. And so in the end, DNC staff were, I want to give credit where it's due, they were incredibly helpful in the end with forming this council. Gave me assistance with writing good bylaws, a lot of back and forth, and I learned a lot from them. And, you know, giving us space and the ability to organize on kind of a short turnaround time in the end. And I was concerned that we were not going to be able to pass and the resolution that authorized this council. But thanks in part, again, to the activists who helped me with reaching out, we had over 50 DNC co-sponsors from all over the country. As you can imagine, the DNC members in places like Puerto Rico and the Eunice Virgin Islands mm-hmm. were especially enthusiastic. But anyway, so we got it passed, and we're all of 2 weeks old, so we haven't done miracles yet. Mm-hmm. but we have a lot of plans, and we're doing outreach already to state and local party, Democratic Party organizations, to encourage them to form their own environmental councils and caucuses. And I am proud to say that there is a county in Maryland that has already formed an environmental caucus inspired by us. So
wow.
We're all done. We have success. No, I'm kidding. yeah, that was so heartening to hear that. And we want to bring everyone together and coordinate, continue to push for this to remain an issue within the DNC, in our national platform, which will be created next summer, associated with the National Nominating Convention in Milwaukee, and at the state party level as well.
You know, it's like what you're saying. I mean, we've seen almost like the evolution of environmental issues from like, okay, well, you need to recycle, to where, I mean, it touches so many things. You know, I'm seeing more people who are planting things so that they can keep butterflies, you know, help the butterfly population. You weren't able to plant. You see more people, they talk about the toxic blooms in the Great Lakes. And, you know, it's more than winters are warmer and, you know, we see ice caps melting. And so it seems like, you know, water levels rising. So it seems like there's no place that it's not touching. And I'm glad to hear that that was on there, because, you know, we still have that other party that has, like, climate change deniers who are denying the science and to me, are denying what's really right in front of them in their own front and backyard. So, I mean, that's, like, to me, like a really stark difference in your home community, you know, and as you're going around talking about it, because like I said, you've been talking about this for a while. Are you seeing that, yeah, there's party lines, but as people are looking at some of this stuff, that it's crossing party lines, is concern about the environment?
Yes, which is such good news. I think you're absolutely right, Michelle. The awareness that these are not just isolated weather events, but part of a much bigger trend is spreading, and it's becoming accepted. And, you know, you actually, I get the Michigan Farm Bureau news, And for a long time, this was not something that was being generally accepted or written about there. It is now. And that's a huge movement if what, you know, we might call Big Ag is starting to see how it's, and even their lobbying organizations are accepting that this is an issue. And I really think this is an issue that we can coalesce around within the Democratic Party, and also a lot of independent voters and even some Republicans can coalesce around climate issues. And it's an area of stark contrast, but it's also an area, the climate issues, where you can reach out to people who have different foci. I mean, we had a lot of Obama voters who didn't vote Democrat, right? Either they didn't turn out or they crossed over and voted for the other side. We had in 2016, and I'm thinking now toward 2020, what do we need to do different? We had young voters who didn't turn out as much as we could hope. We had environmentalists as a block, sad to say, actually have lower voting rates than a lot of other left-leaning groups. And some voted green, and in the presidential election, when I look at all of those, and also we had a lower voting rate among Black and Latinx voters in November 2016 than we'd had in the previous election. So the thing about climate is that when we think of it, as I do, in the context of addressing it with in America with a Green New Deal, you know. The Green New Deal is about environmental justice. It is about jobs, and it is about dealing with this issue, which for many of our young voters is one of their top two issues. So I think if we're smart, we take the Green New Deal idea as a gift, and also, as I said again, we have this moral responsibility, which is so obvious if to me and to you, but and we take it and then we message with it at a state and a local level. So Detroit could be the engine of the Green New Deal. This and other cities in the industrial Midwest. We are addressing those frontline communities dealing with climate changes on coasts. That is what my recommendation is, one of my main recommendations is for Democratic candidates and for our eventual nominee.
When you went to, when you were in San Francisco, and I know that you've gone to other DNC, you know, meetings and things, but do you see it different? I mean, are you seeing more women, more young people, more people of color there than in the past, and not just, you know, and then and taking decision making roles or having their voice heard? Because, you know, I know that I hear particularly young people and people of color who go like, well, I don't like either party. Neither party is listening to us or hearing what we're going through. Are you seeing, is that changing?
The DNC as an institution, the 400 plus of us who are elected out of state parties in different ways, is changing. And the main way I see it changing is that as over time, as, you know, these are 4-year terms, as more people are getting elected, we are electing some younger people, but more people who I would say who are progressive. And, you know, of those of us who are fighting for a climate debate, there's, you know, the core group who is really out there, and then there are obviously, you know, almost 200 members who voted for it. A lot of those people tend, not all, for sure, because there were people like Christine Pelosi who were all in, who've been in the DNC a long time, Larry Cohen, Jim Zogby, but who's the director of the Arab American Institute. But a lot of us were newer DNC members like me. I've only been on there 2.5 years. One of the things that I've did in creating this DNC Environment and Climate Crisis Council was I was very intentional in addressing the issues that younger people and people of color and to some extent women are not heard, don't feel heard because they're not heard. And so, for example, we have a seat reserved for a member of the DNC Black Caucus. There's a seat reserved for the member of the Native American and the Latinx Caucus. We have a seat for labor. We have a youth member who can't be more than so this is the DNC's definition of young is you can't be more than 30. And I see someone from, I know, at first I was going to do like 24, and they said, nah, we're not going to have anyone. We've got a member of the Sunrise Movement who was elected to that position as our youth director. So I would like to say that within this council, we are directly addressing and being really intentional about making sure those voices are heard. We're also intentional about making sure people, we have geographic diversity since the climate issues vary so much over the country and the territories. So we have, you know, someone from the Midwest, we have someone from the West Coast, et cetera.
So that's the young age. Who's the oldest person on the council?
Let's see, not me, so I don't have to reveal my age. You know, David Green, who's the vice chair, and of the council, and he's also the vice chair of the state of Washington's Democratic Party. I'm guessing he's the oldest, and I don't know. But we've got the four elected officers we have so far, and because we're still filling the rest of the positions, we have diversity in terms of the LGBTQ community. In fact, I'm the only cisgender member elected, as they like to tease me. We have two people of color, you know, people from the Midwest, people from the West. So, and we've got the age diversity, too. I think Dee Garcia from California, who was elected, is, you know, like 26. So she's the youngster.
I mean, you know, and that's because, you know, often you hear, I mean, you know, like, you'll hear elders saying, oh, we can't work with those millennials, or one group saying that they aren't. But, you know, this environmental and climate crisis that we have, I mean, we're all on this one beautiful globe. So we have to get over that. And, you know, did you find it was easy to sort of like say to everyone, you know, we all have to be here together and hear each other's voices, but also hear and respect each other's differences? Because, you know, clearly, I mean, what might be you're all concerned about the environment, but how it's expressed in one generation might be different, or one community is different from another. Was that easy to negotiate, or is that a work in process?
So within the council, I think it's been relatively easy because the people who came to the meeting. And by the way, you know, you don't have to be a DNC member to be a member of this council. Certain positions can only be held by DNC members, but we have two of our elected officers are not DNC members. So basically everyone who came to our meeting and who's signed up so far, I think has generally that same perspective that you've expressed so eloquently, Michelle, which is that we are going to have different aspects of this, different perspectives, but our overall goal is the same. And so, you know, we may disagree maybe on priorities, or we may disagree on nuclear energy, or depending on where we're coming from, whether we build seawalls first or windmills first, but we generally are just unified around this, the priority of this and making it happen, and making sure that the Democratic Party continues every day to see every decision it makes through an environmental lens. I think more generally in the DNC, that is not as much the case. And there are, I mean, clearly we had a majority of people who voted against the climate debate. And even though compromises were put forward, I and others had put forward the idea that we could have several issue-based debates, because I understand the perspective that, you know, immigration and racial justice and gun safety and some other issues are also really important. But you know, I'll just give you an example. We had a DNC member who is a lobbyist for the gasifier industry, which is not what I would view as a positive environmentalist industry, tried to run for vice chair. Mm-hmm. So that's still there, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So I know that CNN, well, that's good. You know, so I know that CNN did one, and I noticed that it wasn't, you know, wasn't that big group of people, but they had one climate, I guess for lack of a word, debate. Are there others planned, like specifically like that? And how was the CNN debate planned before this council and the resolution came about?
So the CNN, it was it was planned, I think, as a result of the fact that the DNC leadership was not budging on the idea of there being a climate debate where they were all on the same stage at the same time talking with each other. And that CNN town hall, which happened just a few days ago, I think on the 5th, was 7 hours long. Mm-hmm. And it was, I watched it. I thought it was wonderful, but I also know viewership was extremely low, just hovered above 1 million viewers. And I know a lot of people who are policy wonks who didn't watch it. There's a certain amount of privilege involved in being able to watch something for 7 hours. There is another climate town hall coming up at Georgetown University, and it will include all the candidates. So I believe that one of the Republican challengers to the current president is actually going to be speaking. And I think that will be interesting and good. Everything we can do to get more talk. I was disappointed last night by the ABC debate. There was a single climate question. It came 2 hours into it. A lot of people on the East Coast were already in bed, I think. Mm-hmm. You noticed that too?
Yeah, I was waiting. I kept waiting, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And then not even everyone got to answer it, including, you know, Bernie Sanders, who's, this is one of his main issues. So, and I think they gave Kamala Harris 45 seconds, which, I mean, how can she can't explain her position in 45 seconds. Mm-hmm. So I was really disappointed, especially given that we know many people couldn't make the time to watch the seven-hour form. And there are some really big unanswered questions about the differences between the candidates. When we've got plans for the climate that range from $1.7 billion to almost $17 billion, tenfold difference, we don't understand yet, you know, why that huge difference. They all sound good, you know. They're all saying the right things, which is good. We're going to, you know, go get back into the Paris Climate Accord. We're going to bring our emissions down to net carbon neutral by 2050 or sooner. But that big a price tag difference, there's got to be some really serious differences in the plans, I think, that the American voters deserve to have those differences explained in the media. So I'm looking forward. There's still time.
So we're going to take our first break here. I want to talk about the resolution and then go back to that debate. So we'll be right back. And we're back here on Collections by Michelle Brown, and we're talking with my very good friend, Michelle Regalado-Dietrich. Now, the resolution, you said that a lot of people worked on it and you tried to be, you know, put thoughtful about it. What exactly is a resolution, and what does it, is it just words on the paper, or what's the power behind it?
That's a really good question. So there was the resolution by the DNC that authorized the council, and then we came up with a lengthy set of bylaws because we're Democrats. I think there's both sort of what in presidential politics we call soft power and hard power to this council. The soft power is that it's a bully pulpit. We're 2 weeks old, but we've got social media started up, and we are engaging in the conversation. And you may, if you check out our page on Facebook, the DNC Environmental and Climate Crisis Council page, you're going to see later today a post where we weigh in with our thoughts, some of which you've already heard from me, the current state of the climate town halls and debates and what voters need next. And that's powerful. We also have a collaborative ability in terms of, because we are the DNC, the national party's entity, being able to reach out and collaborate with state party organizations and help encourage them to form. And we are working with the DNC on thinking about, after we have our nominee, how do we ensure that we do better job with voter outreach and voter turnout with environmentally motivated voters. And so we're going to be doing briefings, helping to connect that candidate with the environmental leaders in the various states. And I think that's crucial. We got to win this election. And these were things, you know, the environmental vote was enough by easily enough to make the difference in those key states of Michigan, Wisconsin, where a lot of people in Wisconsin voted green, enough that we could have won it, Pennsylvania, and to some extent Ohio. So because we're a DNC organization, going back to what we can do more internally, so we're hoping to help green DNC operations. I think Democrats ought to walk the talk. I'm not going to press so hard that we spend a lot of money and that we need for winning the presidential election, but over time, we should make our own operations net carbon neutral. And we could think about how the convention could be more environmentally responsible. And I think there's a lot of positive response to that idea within the party. And then there's the party platform next summer. So we would like to see that party platform discussed in a transparent and open way so that not just environmentalists but people with expertise and thoughts based on experience about all the issues can have input, and it happens in the public forum. So that platform, you know, I think some people think, oh, well, it just gets shoved in a drawer and locked away. But if we have, as I certainly hope, a Democratic president, that's that president's platform. So obviously they're going to have a lot of input into that, whoever our nominee is. But it's also very much a reference document for our Democrats in the House of Representatives and in the U.S. Senate. So I think that's a really important place where we can have a voice.
Do you think that by having the councils, and I'm hoping that every state decides to pick one up, you know, and say, let's do this and use the resolution. But do you think that it provides a space where we can have conversations with those who voted for the Green Party and, you know, in a way of reassuring them to sort of say, like, if you come and you vote blue, you're not selling out green, you know, and that there's a space for that and that they'll really feel heard? You know, is that one of the hopes of having these councils?
Absolutely. You said that very well. Thank you. I think bringing together the young people, the people who have voted green, and yes, making sure they have a place within the party to express their opinions. And we're also bringing in labor. And, you know, labor has legitimate concerns about jobs going forward. And it's a place for people to have the conversations that this party needs to have and to feel reassured and to feel heard and to be heard, not just feel heard. So, I think that is crucial. We've got a lot of outreach. We've got a lot on our plate. I'm excited. We're going to be working hard.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I often think, too, that, you know, okay, we are in a crisis here. And so, you know, you can maybe go from green to maybe aqua, you know, for 2020, you know, for 2020. And then, you know, that doesn't mean that it's the end of the Green Party, that there'll never be a, I mean, we're not saying like, you know, just like forget about it, because, you know, that maybe you want to go back there, but it just sort of seems like to me that, you know, we're in a crisis here and we need conversation, and it is a choice right now between blue or red or orange, as the choice may be. You know, I mean, it really is a choice, and it's so important that you have these conversations.
And you know, Howie Hawkins is a Green Party candidate. I've met with him, talked with him. By the way, he had big praise for Bernie Sanders' climate plan. And said so openly, and I found that encouraging, not, you know, in the sense that it showed a real openness by a major Green Party candidate to praising the Democratic nominee. And I think it is true, we have a mostly two-party system, and there is so much at stake in November 2020. When I was in San Francisco, I had the honor of speaking at an event where Annie Leonard, who's the head of Greenpeace, spoke. And she said something that I think I agree with about 90%, because I always have hope. But she said, this election is so pivotal, and if we don't make the right choice, meaning not the current president, then everything's lost. I don't ever think everything's lost, but you know, there was a pith of truth in that. So yeah, I get out there with the green ideas, keep pushing us to the left, but please vote Democrat in November 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, it really is, because, and I sort of get what she's saying, because sometimes I'll be thinking, I'm going like, well, you know what, so everything is sort of interlinked. You know, when you talk about health care, where a lot of our health issues come from a bad environment. And, you know, when you talk about jobs are going away, and that if you fix the environment, a whole lot of things are going to be fixed. But sometimes it's people get in their silos and they don't want to think about that. I am really encouraged by the fact that you said that you got union and labor are engaged with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Larry Cohen, who is the retired president of Communication Workers of America, has been incredibly helpful in forming this council. I'm a UAW member myself. I care and I fight for workers' rights, and will continue to do so within the environmental movement. I think what people are calling the just transition, so that union jobs are not just preserved, but let's make sure that these new renewable energy jobs are also union jobs and are good paying with good benefits. Hopefully they won't need health care, because we're going to have Medicare for all, but other benefits. I do think there's such an opportunity here, and I'm hopeful.
What do you say to people, you know, now that you've got this council, you know, people hear these things, you know, the Amazon is burning, you know, we're losing land here, the glaciers are melting, you know, the Arctic is melting, sea level. But sometimes, like, we see so much and we hear so much that some people get numb to it and really sort of look at, like, hey, you know, I just want to have a job, a good job. You know, I'm concerned about issue A. How do we resensitize them to the environmental issues?
When you talk about that, I'm reminded of something that I may have mentioned on a previous show that you were kind enough to have me on, this idea in poetry of familiarization and defamiliarization, that what language used well can do is to help make us sensitized again, aware of the familiar in a way to make it unfamiliar. So, and it's true. I mean, the news every day, there's something, and you know, every July is hotter, the hottest July, right?
Mm-hmm.
2019 was the hottest July. 2018 was the hottest July before that, and you become numb. And I think also there's numbness, and there's also something close to despair that we can fall into, feeling that we can never do enough, that our small part isn't enough. And one way we do this is with shows like yours, Michelle. So thank you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I do a fair amount of public speaking,
mm-hmm.
and I often reach to poetry because it helps people think in a different space and in a different way. But I think we also have to keep sharing that news, because it's actually amazing that 4 out of 5 Americans don't so I live in one sort of social media bubble and news bubble where I receive this news all the time, but there are other Americans who don't, a surprising percentage of them, the majority, who are not getting environmental news every day. And so sharing and continuing to speak about it with the horror and the hope that it deserves, I think, helps a lot. What do you think? I'm all ears about ideas
I think that you are so right, because, I mean, I was in Atlanta, and then I was also here in Detroit. And part of what I was doing poetry. But in the poetry, like you said, it's sort of like when I was here in Detroit, I was doing one part where we're talking about, you know, thinking about tomorrow, thinking beyond today, and having hope and finding the beauty that's in there. And, I mean, there was a young couple that just happened to walk in, and the guy said, you know, that's what I needed to hear. So it's important that, yeah, sometimes we have to get up there and, you know, bring the fire to people, but sometimes we have to use things like poetry, use music, and talk about that to where, like you said, that you're able to find words that touch someone, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's so important.
And part of that is finding the venues to do it. So we know the global climate strike is coming up on the 20th, next Friday, and I've heard some people say we have too many rallies, too many events, people aren't actually getting things done. And I've thought very hard about that, and I disagree. And I think that those events in part help desensitize us, to give opportunities for people to hear those words of poetry and of hope, and to hear about things they may not know about yet. And what I'm also seeing more and more is that those rallies, and I try to do this with rallies I organize, they are becoming more than rallies. I know in Ann Arbor, and I believe also in Detroit, that the climate rallies are going to be followed by workshops. There's going to be tabling by ally organizations so people can get connected to the movement and keep going with the work after the rally.
And, you know, the other thing, when I was in Atlanta and we were in a neighborhood and they were talking about, like, rehabbing a house, but there was an amazing yard. And we talked about gardens and green space. And we had everyone there from elders to kids to talk about, you know, you don't have to build up everything, and how do you reclaim the earth and growing things. And we even talked about water shortages and you know, how did you do this? And you know, and to vision. And it was like, to me, it was so great, because in that conversation, some of these kids who primarily their life had been in the city were able to talk about some other things. And some of them even brought up some of the things they were seeing on the news, talking about other climate crises and recognizing, you know, that it was in their control. And many of them charging those of us who were adults to, like, you know, do something. This is our future.
That sounds like a beautiful, beautiful moment.
Mm-hmm.
One to treasure. And I, it's so interesting to me how the relationship of youth and elders has been reversed from what I've sort of grew up expecting through this engagement with our society and our world with the climate crisis, and with youth taking the lead very much, but also and informing us, but also I've heard so much appreciation from youth about something that I say, which is, yeah, the youth are taking the lead in informing, and but it's my generation and the generations before us that got us here. And so we need to continue to step forward as allies and in support and take leadership also, which is part of this DNC council because, you know, as I mentioned, a youth on the DNC is like in their 30s. So while we're centering youth in part on that council, we also have this work to do. And I think it's going to take all of us working together. One thing I'm not sure is always messaged well about this, not 12 years, people keep saying 12 years, it's only 11 years now before, you know, we think we're reaching a tipping point, is that even if we do everything we're talking about doing in the next 11 years, the world is still irrevocably changed, right?
Mm.
It's not going to get better than it is now. It will still be at a worse point, just not so much worse that we think that it will be unlivable for large parts of the earth. And that reality is the responsibility of all of us to address, as you do.
You know, I think it's encouraging when you hear things, when you see countries are saying, like, okay, that they're paying people to plant trees, you know. I mean, people are trying to, I've heard people talk about, like, you know, I don't need to buy anymore, you know, and recycling and reusing, but also, you know, we don't need to build up every single space, and how do we co-house? And like, all of this touches everything, you know, every part of our lives, and that's what's so amazing to me. Well, we're going to take a second break, and then, we're going to take a second break. I want to talk briefly about these debates, and moving forward towards 2020. So we'll be right back.
Michelle?
Okay, and we're back here. Michelle, okay, the debates. First, we had the huge one, the two-night one in Detroit. We had the one in Austin, and then I think the next one is in Ohio. We've got all these people here up there, I think, we both mentioned earlier how I watched last night and I was like, when are they going to talk about the environment? When are they going to talk about the environment? And then it was like so quick,
yeah,
you know, so quick. And it's like, that's it?
Yeah. there was time for everyone to say, yes, I care about the environment. I felt sorry for them, actually, because what can you do in 45 seconds, you know?
Exactly, you know. I mean, and there are some points, you know, if you're not talking about it, how do you look at these children, your grandchildren, how do you look in the mirror when you know that you're not addressing it, but you had 45 seconds, and that's all you had, you know, that's all anybody had. We need to have a really substantive conversation about this. And even going, you know, I would hate to find, based on what we've seen when we get to the convention, that I don't know more about, you know, where somebody stands on the environment and what they're really going to do. I know many people have started to put out papers. Bernie has, Elizabeth Warren has, you know, they've put out really comprehensive things. But what's the message that you're looking for as you watch these debates?
So stepping back just a little bit, there's sort of three schools of thought about how Democrats should message. One is the go after Trump messaging, which our Democratic base likes. There's sort of a second one, which is don't talk at all about Trump and just stand for our values. And there's a third one, which says let's be smart and careful with our anti-Trump messaging. But when you're, but don't do it in a way where you're sinking to his level, and then also be standing up for our values. And I think that all of that applies to people talking about climate and the environment, right? So I think that I'll just be blunt. I don't think that the debates so far have done a very good job of showing what is a really great group of candidates. I mean, these are some amazing people who've done amazing things. Whoever your candidate is, if you have chosen one, I mean, everyone I talk to, nearly everyone I talk to says, yeah, but you know, this other person, right, is also, or these three people. So I would love to see debates that allowed our candidates to dive into a few issues more deeply, each one of them. And the truth is that even though the DNC has chosen not to negotiate contracts that demand that, you know, these contracts are signed with networks, the networks can still choose to do that. And I, you know, I'm gonna be starting to call out ABC on my social media, and we can put pressure on all of them to allow our candidates to explore and explain their positions much better. And I think, again, that focusing on the using the Green New Deal as sort of a framework for how we can address the climate crisis and other environmental issues, and it allows us to think of them holistically and intersectionally, that, you know, it's about race and it's about income and it's about jobs. And that's an important messaging for those portions of the electorate that voted for Trump. Yes, there was a lot of racism, overt undercurrents, but there's also a lot of economic fear and economic insecurity. And we can't speak to that part legitimately and speaks to our youth. And so using that as the framework, and then also, though, not on a national debate stage to a great extent, but to some extent, even there, taking that message down to the state level. And this speaks to another thing that's disappointed me about the debates, is that, you know, when it was, the debate was in Detroit, I was expecting questions about the Great Lakes and preserving the Great Lakes. I was expecting, why are we having the debates all over the country if we're not using them as an opportunity to explore regional and state-level issues and how the candidates' platforms would apply to those states? I think that's crucial. And, you know, all voting, all politics is local, and I think we need to debates that allow our candidates to speak to show how their platforms and their policies apply more specifically to those regional and state-level issues.
You know, I thought that, too, because here, I mean, Michigan, they keep saying, Michigan is so critical, Michigan is so critical. And here, what, you had two nights. Yep. Talk about the Great Lakes, you know. Talk about Michigan and the region. I mean, and you could talk not only about Michigan, but, I mean, all the states that border the Great Lakes. I mean, and that it was like a missed opportunity.
It was, yep. And I think last night on ABC was a little better, but not much. So it was a missed opportunity, and I'm hoping we're going to have, as you mentioned, the next debate is going to be in Ohio. I don't think we have the city yet for that, but there's another opportunity. And the Great Lakes are, you know, toxic algae blooms and you know, Asian carp. And I don't think the rest of the country is aware of it either to a great extent. And it's an opportunity to showcase that, but also to showcase these really great candidates and how they would make their policies apply, not just nationally, but more specifically, so we're not just getting sound bites. And when I say that about sound bites, I'm not criticizing the candidates. I think that they're being put in a structure where it's really hard for them to do anything else.
Why do you think that on one side they're trying to demonize the Green New Deal? There are some people who seem to me are afraid of the Green New Deal, and there's so many uncertainties or lack of information about it.
That's an excellent question. I believe that to much too great of an extent that the Democratic Party has become aligned with corporate interests, and that anytime you talk about an enormous transformation of our economy and society like this, you are threatening some of those corporate interests. You're threatening the fossil fuel industry, which has enormous influence. And that is part of why it's so important that we take this up. It was several candidates last night. I think Senator Warren and Senator Sanders were among the foremost, but they were certainly not the only ones who talked about corruption or domination of our government and party by corporate interests. And the fact that these debates are even being held, they're being run not like by the League of Women Voters, right?
Mm-hmm.
But by corporations that are making the decisions about the questions should give us all pause, because they chose not to center climate issues. Did I answer your question, Michelle? I really do think that that's it, and I also think that the fact that the Democratic Party has been seen by many, especially youth, as being so aligned with corporate interests is part of the problem we're having with environmental and youth voter turnout.
I think the other thing that, as you looked at, you know, like you said, they had a great panel of people. I mean, when they had 20, it was a lot, but here, even like last night with 10, there's still a lot of people, but such a great, and coming from different backgrounds and a lot of different experiences, that you didn't get a chance to hear from them. And just like you said, how we should put the whole burden on young people, that we have these different generations that we have to do what we have to do to make it able for them to step into those positions. But like you said, everybody was so fast, you didn't get to hear that, you know. It's sort of like, well, I mean, I was looking at some slight one thing, and they said, well, you know, you had some who were old, others who were younger, but it's like all of our issue and all of it. And so to see that, to have that kind of conversation, to sort of show that it isn't one generation or the other, it's all generations, all hands on deck, you know, that's important to me as we move into the 2020 elections.
It would be nice to see that environmental issues and all the intersectional issues related to it became a really top priority for all voters up and down the age spectrum, right? And it is. It's crucial, because we can't do what we need to do without, as you say, everyone being on deck. It's going to take everyone working together in small ways and in the big ways. A lot of people have talked about this as being, you know, kind of like the war effort in World War II, except in this case, the whole world has to be on the same side.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of why I have hope, because we have all pulled together for other efforts before. But it is going to take a willingness to take on some entrenched interests in the party and in the government, and a willingness to kind of step out where we can't always see exactly where our foot is going to fall in terms of this big transformation that has to happen and has to happen so fast. By the time 2020 rolls around, it'll be 10 years left, right? By the time the election happens. That's not much time.
Yeah, especially because, I mean, it'd be not much time if everything just stayed as it was, but you have an administration that is going to roll back as much as they can in this one year.
You know, I was just thinking about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
As the previous governor of Michigan did, right before he left office, right? Especially in that period of time between the election and inauguration, I think we can look to see some, well, I would love to be wrong. So, you know, have me on your show in a year and a half, and you'll say, Michelle, you were totally wrong. But I think you're right. I think there will be an effort to roll back everything, to make appointments that make it difficult to do what we need to do. So lots of work to do.
Well, you know, I would love to see once we get, once the dust settles and we have a candidate, first of all, how important it is that, you know, and I've been reading a lot of it, that everybody comes together, you know, and there's a place for everyone in some way, but we all come together behind this candidate and nobody sits it out. You know, everybody has to sit it out. What do you see? What's the hardest thing that you see between now and then, building up to it, you know, the primaries and everything? What do you see is going to be the hardest amount of work that you're going to have to do?
Me personally?
Well, you and the council.
And the council. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the work that we're doing with outreach to communities that care deeply about the environment is, in fact, crucial work for 2020. And it's interesting because when I first started thinking about the council, you know, way back last January, December, I wasn't thinking of it in those terms, but I was thinking of it solely in terms of fighting the climate crisis. But this is also a way of fighting the climate crisis, just not quite as directly. And I think there's a delicate balance between calling for unity too soon, when and we saw that, and letting and the party kind of coming to be very divided, and we saw that tension on stage last night between candidates who were saying we have to all be unified, we just need to elect a Democrat, and candidates who were saying, hey, this is a primary, this is a time when we have to explore differences, and a tension between legitimately calling attention to differences in platforms among the candidates, but not doing it in a, I don't know, in a way that is, you know, personal or hostile, like having that old-fashioned thing, a civil conversation. And that's hard when we're talking about the climate, because I will not make any secret of the fact that I think that some of these candidates have much better plans than others, plans that will actually get the work done, and others, I'm really concerned, you know. But so I'm watching things carefully, and, you know, as soon as we've got a candidate, just like last time, you know, my candidate lost the primary, and I was out there campaigning for Hillary Clinton as hard as I could. And I will be again. I want to model that, no matter how it turns out. And I think because of 2016, there's a greater awareness of that need. I am hearing a lot of people saying that who didn't necessarily take that position last time because we all thought we were going to win. You know, we've learned. We have learned.
We have learned.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I think that you do, and that I hope that members of the party and it catches away. You do a lot on campuses with young people. These, their voices, the things that they bring, the things that they see, the passion that they bring into it, and providing them the voice is so important. Yeah, and it's important that they stand there. You've got them on your council. Like I said, you continue when they want to. They were there for the Planned Parenthood. They're there for the Women's March. They're participating and they're doing it. These are our future leaders. And also, they're seeing the world as they do today. Because, like, you know, we can say, oh, well, you know, we had issues then. But, you know, what they see is their issues are different and they're going forward. It's important to keep them involved.
It's also a great pleasure and a privilege, Michelle. Thank you for bringing this up. I'm working with students right now at Michigan State and University of Michigan Ann Arbor, and hope to be reaching out more about a number of things, including the environment. And I sometimes think, do they really want to talk to me? Because, you know, I'm like their mom's age. Mm-hmm. But I ask them that, and I hope they're answering honestly when they say yes, they mm-hmm. want me there. Mm-hmm. It's been a pleasure to have the opportunity to, you know, to share how to organize things, to share the skills, to hear from them, because even over the, you know, past 4 or 5 years, their concerns change as some of them age out. It's a pleasure to see many of them move into, you know, working on campaigns, working for state parties, seeing them blossom and bloom. And an interesting thing that someone said to me, University of Michigan, one of the students said to me a couple days ago, was that I had the knowledge of, you know, some of the, I had the knowledge of how it was on campus 5, 6 years ago that was really valuable to them. So it is absolutely vital. And I, one of the things I'd love to see, this is sort of a tangent, if you'll forgive me, but the DNC meetings used to overlap occasionally with the meetings of the College Democrats, and I would arrange to have dinner with the Michigan College Democrats always to connect with them and learn. I'm hoping that that's stopped happening, and I'm working with some people to try to make it happen again, that we have to institutionalize and structure things so that the voices of the elders and the voices of the youth are, that they're both hearing each other at every level. So sorry, that's one of my passions.
No,
got me started.
So I totally agree with you, because, you know, and in their mind are sometimes the keys to it. You know, when I was in Atlanta, there was this young person was doing something on their tablet, and they were doing like that. And she said, you know, I want to learn how to do that. She said, we used to have to use a mimeograph machine, and we couldn't reach people, but how do you do that? And these brains, these are the answers to the future. We might not see what it is if we stay, you know, looking at it from our lens, but from hearing our history and our experiences, them blending it with their experiences and their vision, the answers might be right closer, you know, on how in 10 years that maybe we can do something, make something better, you know, than what we, this doom and gloom that if we keep running it the way that we are, is ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. And I can't remember which candidate said this last night, but this idea that there are opportunities, good things can come out of our grappling with the climate crisis, I think is, it's not just about giving people hope. I think it is true. And I do think that we need to focus on that. That's part of why I love the Green New Deal, is because there is a positive aspect to it, not just this news that we get desensitized to. I shouldn't say just, but it is hard to take in all the horrible things that are happening and that we can't directly address as individuals. And so having that sense of hope and of the building a movement for more, what's going to happen next around that next mm-hmm. turn that could be great, is absolutely crucial. And yes, it needs all of us and the wisdom and that tech know-how that many of the younger people have. They're looking 50, 60 years into the future in a way that, just full disclosure, at my age, I'm looking there, but I won't be around. So unless there's a whole other revolution that I don't know about happening. So.
There's a whole other matter. Who knows? But, you know, we'll be there in spirit.
We will.
There go those two Michelles, you know. We wouldn't, you know, they raised a lot of hell, but, you know, they're here in spirit. So that's you know. So, Michelle, as we're coming to the close, I want to go over. Now, you said that you don't have to be a member of the DNC to be part of the Environmental and Climate Council. How do people find out about it? You said there's a Facebook page, and what else?
There is a Facebook page, and very soon on that Facebook page will go a membership sign up form so that you can just sign up. And mm-hmm. And then as part of that form is going to be whether you're interested in serving on a committee. So you can apply to serve on one of our committees. So far we have committed, again, we're 2 weeks old, but we're planning a youth committee with that, probably that. We're negotiating the age cutoff there. And we'll have probably an outreach committee. And if people want to propose other things, they should speak up. So, that's the way to do it. Go to the Facebook page. And people are also welcome to email me. I'm Michelle@MichelleDietrich.com. Michelle with two L's, Dietrich, DEATRICK.com. And I would welcome being in touch.
Well, I think that's great, Michelle. I know I will see you. We will continue to do this work because we're the two Michelles. We've got work to do. You know,
We've got work to do. Thank you. It's always so good talking to you. Thank you for everything that you do, and thank you for having me on the show.
Well, and I hope that next year we can plant and the earth recovers, because that's one of the beauties of it. Unless we, you know, no matter how hard we try, Mother Earth comes back. And so I look forward to seeing that. Okay?
I am looking forward to not seeing a lot of weeds out on that 40 acres. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, look, I will talk to you very soon. Enjoy the rest of your day. And thank you again.
Thank you. Have a terrific weekend. Bye-bye.
I want to thank today's guest, Michelle Regalado-Dietrich. Michelle is chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee's Environmental and Climate Council that was established at the party's summer meeting in San Francisco this past August. Be sure and follow Collections by Michelle Brown Blog Radio on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And let us know if you have a suggestion for a guest or topic for a future show. You can listen to this or past episodes of the show on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, or Blog Talk Radio. Join us next week when I'll introduce you to another amazing individual living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of your intersectionality and creating change right here on Collections by Michelle Brown. Thank you for listening.